Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello, What Went Wrong family. We are dropping another Below the Line episode from our vault for you to enjoy. We recorded this episode with Dave Kamaitis the day after the Oscars last year, March 13th, 2023. So some of the references may be a bit out of date, but the information certainly is not. Dave runs the website The Op, which is an amazing resource, not only for camera operators, but for anybody who works on set. He also runs a podcast called The Op, where he interviews his below-the-line colleagues. It is a blast to listen to, and you will learn a ton. As you'll learn in this episode, Dave is one of the most prolific and accomplished Steadicam operators to have worked in this business. He is an invaluable resource. So without further ado, we give you Dave Kamaitis. Hello, and welcome back to another special Patreon episode of What Went Wrong Below the Line with Chris Winterbauer and, as always, my lovely co-host, Lizzie Bassett. Lizzie, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great. I'm very, very excited about our guest today.
As am I. Today, guys, you have the pleasure of listening to Dave Kamaitis. Dave Kamaitis has been a local 600A camera Steadicam operator for over 20 years. He has won 2 Primetime Emmy Awards. He was nominated for an SOC Operator of the Year Award in 2013 for the film St. Vincent. He won that same award, I believe I'm getting this right, this year for his work on Ozark Season 4. It would eat up an episode reading his credits, but here are a few of my personal favorites, Dave, if you'll indulge me. From Dusk Till Dawn, ER, Donnie Darko, I have a question about a specific shot in that movie, Jurassic Park 3, Wedding Crashers, The West Wing, Beginners, Shame, Moonrise Kingdom, The Heat, Boardwalk Empire, The Good Wife, The Americans, Lucifer, and The Tragedy of Macbeth. Again, check out his IMDb.
Insane.
The list goes on way longer than that. Dave, welcome to What Went Wrong. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's an honor to talk to you guys. I'm a huge fan of the show. And that was interesting because I was wondering what you were going to pull out. And you pulled out most of the usual suspects, but you actually didn't pull out one that I assumed you would. I thought you were going to pull out Tremors.
You know?
How did you not?
I missed it. I must have missed it.
No, but here's the thing. Now that I think about it, you looked on IMDb?
I did.
Tremors was the first thing I ever did,
and
I did miniature visual effects. I worked with Bob and Denny Skotak, and we did all the worms. And remember that great sequence where the worm slams through the
retaining wall.
The rec room. Yeah. You broke into the wrong goddamn rec room.
And they're just grabbing guns off the wall.
Exactly. Yeah. So I don't know if you remember it, but there's like it's like it slams in, and then there's a whip pan over to Michael Gross and Rita McIntyre. We built that whole miniature room.
Amazing.
And I remember like taking, because I had no idea what I was doing, and they were like, go make Pepsi cans. And so I was like taking pictures of Pepsi cans and like cutting them out and putting them around these little rings. I still have one on the desk here somewhere, actually. Yeah.
Amazing.
But now I will forgive you that because it's actually not on the main list.
Thank you. Because that's a classic. I love that. Love that
one
movie.
One of my favorite movies.
It's a great,
I love
great
Tremors.
Film.
I will say also, I knew you would pick out Donnie Darko because it doesn't make a difference what I do with the rest of my life.
No.
Everybody will want to talk about Donnie Darko.
I rewatched it because I saw it when I was 17.
Sure.
And I had the, you know, oh my God, my life will never be the same again. I am a 17-year-old white male moment. But then I rewatched it recently and I was surprised at how well it held up. I think it is an incredible film with a great tone.
It's a great movie.
I don't want to rat hole on Donnie Darko quite yet because we have a lot to get through
with you,
Dave.
We do. And I also will do my very best not to rat hole on Justified City Primeval, which I saw as your upcoming credit because I'm a big fan. But
yeah.
I hope we didn't
disappoint you. You'll have to tell me after you see it.
I'll give you a very harsh review.
Yeah, exactly.
Please do. No, actually, I think it's going to be good. The only thing that was interesting about that was when did that show go off the air? Like,
oh my gosh, I want to
say a long time ago, right?
2011, is that right?
Yeah. So the weird thing was, like, we just shot it last summer, and it was trying to convince them that you can't make the same TV show that was being made in 2011 because TV has massively changed, right?
Yeah.
Mm.
Dave, I realize there's one question that we should have put first on our question list, so I hope this doesn't catch you out of left field. But the very first question, you are a Steadicam operator.
Yes.
To anyone who does not know, what is a Steadicam and what does a Steadicam operator do?
Okay, so I'll back into it. The Steadicam operator operates the Steadicam.
Great.
And the Steadicam is this gizmo that was created by Garrett Brown, who is an amazing inventor. Basically, the long short story of it is that cameras used to be massive and then they got smaller and people put them on their shoulder and ran around with them. And that was the only way they could really move them freely, if you want, not on dolly track. And so they came up with a French word for it called cinema verite because it was better than saying handheld. And Garrett was messing around and was like, there's got to be a better way to do this. And he came up with this system that's a three-part system, basically. And there's a vest that attaches to your body. So it basically becomes like an exoskeleton. And there's an arm that sort of it has two parts to it with springs in it that looks like one of those arms that hangs off of like an architect's desk that you can put the lamp wherever you want. That's conceptually like it is. And that sort of acts as your forearm. And that attaches to the Steadicam, which has a three-way moving gimbal. And so the idea is that you can put a camera on it and weight it out correctly and blah, blah, blah. And if you know what you're doing, you can run through a house with it. You can walk upstairs with it. You can go anywhere a human being can go, more or less. And make it look smooth. So, a great example that most people know is ER or West Wing. Those were big, camera moving shows. And ER was the show actually that I've been skating off of my entire career that I got on very young somehow and didn't screw it up. It was sort of the first show that kind of made Steadicam not a specialty tool, but like a full part of every production. And now you really don't go on shows without seeing a Steadicam. By the way, at the beginning of my reel and at the end of my reel, there's a video of me at the Emmys on there where you can see me wearing the Steadicam. And then there's a little movie that explains what it is, probably better than I just did.
Check that out. And really quickly, too, to our audience members, if you've seen Aliens, you have actually seen a Steadicam because the suit that some of the soldiers wear with the converted MG-42 machine gun hanging off the side of it, that's actually a converted Steadicam with a prop machine gun attached, a World War II machine gun attached. So you've seen a Steadicam. And of course, there are innumerable, famous shots, Steadicam shots, Goodfellas, The Shining, obviously, and Dave, we'll get into him, but you've seen the work of the Steadicam. And like Dave said, the operator can go places that dolly track can't, and it looks smooth. And that was a remarkable creation. And do you remember, that was 1970?
The movie
was in the
70s. The movie, it's the Woody Guthrie story, and I always forget the name of the movie that it first came out on. But Garrett did this shot that was a step off of a crane into a crowd. It'll come back to me at some point. I can't think of the name.
Great.
But, and apparently when they showed it, like, people just lost their minds. Like, now we can't conceptualize it because it's just like we're so used to cameras going everywhere. But back then it was like, what's happened?
Exactly. Yeah. Had the camera just a ghost picked it up off of the crane and carried it forward.
Yeah, people just couldn't get their heads around how it was done. So,
it's amazing.
It was literally something that he like locked himself in a motel for 3 weeks messing around with ideas and came up with this idea and put together a videotape of like him running around, which you can see on the internet.
You can see it on YouTube, yeah. Like
you see it on YouTube. And the great thing is like he's totally 70s out with like the flared pants and the hair going back and everything. But he's like running around barbecues and stuff like that. It's amazing. Yeah.
So Dave, I'm here to ask the dumb questions because I know a lot less about how to actually operate what you're operating. And my first dumb question is something you said was, you said, you know, and if you know what you're doing, you do X, Y, and Z. So as someone like me who does not know exactly what goes into actually operating the Steadicam, what are you really controlling other than holding this piece of equipment on your body as you're moving? What are the kind of things that you are keeping an eye on?
Well, I mean, you're basically doing the exact same job as any operator. So you're framing the story. And I mean, at the end of the day, look, operating is 100% about story and everything should, story leads everything. If it actually becomes a rep about the shot, I personally think you have not done your job well. And there have been times where I've sort of looked at people and gone, I think this is becoming about the shot and I don't think it should be about the shot. And we try to pull back or I try to pull it back. But telling the story, framing, headroom, et cetera, the same things that you're doing as an operator. But then you're also a lot of times you're walking backwards. So you have a spotter on you. You have, depending on the camera, anywhere from like maybe 40 to 65 pounds on you. And it's like wearing a backpack, but the thing is, because of how the arm is and where the weight is, your center of gravity goes from being in the center of your body to slightly forward of your body. So you're actually leaning backwards. I mean, to quote unquote master it, which to me means you could go onto a set and not worry that you're going to totally screw up, is probably anywhere from like 2 to 5 years, I would think. and when I bought my first Steadicam, I actually ran around my apartment building. I was actually delivering prosthetic hips to hospitals in California, which is as amazing as it sounds.
That is a Hollywood job.
I was like, if I'm going to go, I'm going to go big. I was doing that during the day. And at night, I would literally run around my apartment building, like scaring people as they open their doors with this thing to try to figure out how to do it. And then actually, there used to be a company called FM Rocks that would do like 6 rap videos in a weekend. And I actually used to work there with, and the cinematographer I worked with was Matty Libatique, who's become
my
massive.
Oh, wow.
He's shockingly, but if I could show you some of the things that we did. But the great thing was like, we got paid nothing, but they didn't care because they're like, hey, move that thing. And so you learned how to use it because you could mess up and it didn't make a difference. But there's a tremendous amount of balance. I mean, to give you an idea, like, it's sort of like doing Tai Chi with like cement bags tied to you because you have to be extremely elegant with it and it's very finesse. And one of the things that you have to mess with, although now they're electronic stabilizers, but I won't get into that, is the horizon. Because if you don't if you don't do it really well, it'll sort of like rock like a boat as you're going. And if you know what you're looking for, you can tell bad Steadicam very, very
you can.
Easily.
And that's why it's on a pan. If it's on a really good Steadicam operator, that horizon line is so dead even when you're panning. And then I feel like there's that slight tilt into the pan, and that's instantly when you can tell. And there have been some movies I've watched recently where I'm like, oh my God, that pan was so clean, so cleanly executed. It's just, And Dave, you set it up now for us to dive into our next question perfectly, which is, aside from needing to get away from the artificial hip industry, what brought you? Right, exactly. He's still slinging them from the back of his car.
Yeah, exactly.
What drew you, obviously to film in general? Because as you said, Steadicam operators are storytellers, and that's something that we're trying to get across throughout this entire series. 100%. Everybody that works on a film set is a storyteller. They are all engaging very specific disciplines in order to help tell a story. But what brought you to camera operating and Steadicam operating in particular? Because it's obviously something that you have such a talent for, but it's also so specific. So I'm curious how you reached it.
So when I was seven, I saw Star Wars and I wanted to be a Jedi Knight. And then at some point, my entire world was dashed and I realized that wasn't a thing. And then I thought, I want to be the people who like made the Jedi Knight or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to be in film. And I knew I grew up in Connecticut. It's like, you know, burgeoning film community there. And I had zero idea. And I was like, I guess you go to college for it. And so I went to NYU, and which had its ups and downs. And then my sophomore year, before the summer, two friends from Connecticut and I were like, let's get a car and go to California. And we were like, okay, because we were stupid and we had nothing to do. And and we drove out there and we got here. And I don't know really what I was thinking. I didn't really think I'd go and be like, hey, everybody's going to be like, Dave's here, you know?
He made it!
I didn't think it through. A lot of my career has been not thinking things through, actually. And I got out here and we didn't have a place to stay. So we stayed on the floor of my buddy's mother's college roommate, who happened to be a producer for this. As it happens, who happened to be a producer for this company called Forward Productions. That, among other things, they did the Water Worm in the Abyss.
Oh, wow.
And Terminator 2, which I ended up working with them. And she called them up and she's like, I got this kid here. You got to hire him. And
they were
like,
you got to get him off my floor right
exactly.
now.
Yeah, we'll pay you, you know, I don't know, $50 a day or whatever, and you'll be a production assistant. And a production assistant for Forward Productions was basically like, one day the cameraman was teaching me how to thread the camera, and another day I was like putting up girders on the ceiling, and another way they were teaching me how to weld and I mean whatever. Wow. And I was working on this movie called Tremors, and I was just like, this is interesting. And I went back to school and just realized I'm paying a lot of money to basically learn I don't know what I'm doing. And I have to say, my parents are very educated, very professional people. My dad's a pediatric cardiologist, and I went to another one and I said, I'm dropping out of school and I'm going into the film industry. And they were like, okay. And they actually supported me in it, and they did not understand any of it. And to this day, by the way.
Yeah, they're still like, how's that career going?
to this day, my dad will be like, he'll call me up and be like, you're working? No, because I'm freelancing. You got any work coming up? Nothing right now. I'm like, so like it got to the point where I'd be lying. I'd be like, yes, I have to go to work now, Dad, because he can't handle the fact that I don't always know where my next job is coming from. But anyway, they really supported me. So I came out here and worked for Forward again, because they said, if you ever come back. And I did this movie called Clifford with Martin Short that nobody ever heard of. And then Terminator 2, we did the nuclear blowing LA up.
Amazing.
And then I was kind of like, I want to be in the camera world and not breathe in toxic fumes all the time. So I left there and got into camera assisting, and then saw a Steadicam, and it just blew my mind. And I literally was like, I have to do this. How do I do this? It was one of those weird things in your life that doesn't happen to most people where you go, that's what I'm going to do. Mm. And then somehow I was able to do it.
Lizzie, as a podcaster who watches a ton of movies, how do you find time to cook stress-free, healthy, and affordable meals?
I don't, because this spring I've been eating delicious, ready-to-eat meals from Factor. They're chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and delivered right to my door.
Okay, but are they big-time floppers, or are they actually good?
Honestly, they're literally gourmet. I'm talking filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter. Factor gets you a 2-minute chef-prepared meal on the table with no prep and no mess.
And they have a weekly menu of 35 options for picky eaters like my daughter, including vegan and veggie.
And they've got 60 add-ons every freaking week, like breakfast, snacks, and beverages to keep you fueled through those movie marathons.
Plus, you can celebrate Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on their lowest carbon footprint meals. Do it for the children, my children.
So head to factormeals.com/WWW50 and use code WWW50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box.
That's code WWW50 at factormeals.com/WWW50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
I also have to say my dad is an amateur but very good photographer, and I spent a lot of my childhood like in the darkroom developing and watching stuff develop, and I think there's an innate sense of storytelling there.
Well, you know? And just the knowledge of how to frame an image. And as much as, you know, obviously the director and the cinematographer are going to weigh in, but at the end of the day, getting to our next question, once the director and the cinematographer step away, it's just you and the actors. It's this really intimate dance when you get to watch it. It's really cool.
It's the best. Yeah.
Sometimes the actor leads. Sometimes you can tell the operator's leading and the actor's using them for positioning. Can you describe that relationship? Because very few people on set get to have such an intimate relationship with the actors. And could you describe that relationship and how you improvise, you know, off of them and they off of you in order to get the shot that you need to tell the story?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot to that question. One of the weird things about the film industry is like you're working with millionaires and these people who are massive stars and whatever. And so early on, I just decided, you know what, they're just people like everyone else. And some of them are, you know, some of them are schmoes and some of them are cool and whatever. And so over the years, I've just sort of treated everybody like everybody else and that they were no more important, even though I will say an actor is in front of the camera and they're bearing themselves. And I think that they have potentially a harder job than most other people on set for that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the things that I was taught early on, or I learned early on, was that part of my job is, obviously my job is to frame and to tell the story and this and that and the other. But the other part of that is to, and I don't know how to say this without sounding all woke, but because I'm not intending to sound woke, but to create like a safe space for them where it's like, because I've been in situations where people are like, I mean, doing really, really emotional work. Mm-hmm. And I've had people look at me and go, I'm going to use you. Okay. And I'm like, I'm here for you. And I'll literally like back when I used to have, or when you're doing handheld, but back when we used to have our eye in the eyepiece all the time, which I don't anymore, which drives me nuts because the video ruins your eyes. Mm-hmm. There were times where I would keep my other eye open so I could make eye contact with them. And look, the reality is there are some actors who literally are like, I don't like you here. Mm-hmm. You're like, now this is going to be a fun couple of months. And then there are some actors who I've become really good friends with. And it's literally just because I'm like, yeah, you're an actor and you're this and that and the other, but I'm also this. I'll tell you, by the way, Jamie Lee Curtis, who just won an Academy Award last night, I could not be happier for, because she's the most wonderful person in the entire world. Like everything you want Jamie Lee Curtis to be, she is.
Oh, good.
She's so great. And I worked with her on Scream Queens 2 or something like that, but she was like the first person on set and the last person and just the most professional. So you run into people like that who just like, you know, for every person who I won't say who you've worked with, who you're like, wow, I don't know that I'd completely stop my car if you were crossing the street. No, that's terrible. That would never happen. Because I'd get my name in the paper. Then you meet people like that and you're like, this is great. But, did that answer your question? I'm not sure if I answered your question.
You were asking
also about sort of the dance and whatever, which with Steadicam, there is a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's like everything else. Like you can, you know, you can be dancing with a dancing partner and stepping all over their feet. And then you can dance with someone else and just everything falls into place. And there are some times where it just all works. And I personally, if the director and the director of photography are hip to it and will allow me to do it, I'll improvise a lot when I'm filming, because there will just mm-hmm. be moments where they're the best thing in the world. You mentioned that, you know, you're in there and the camera's rolling. It's like, you know, sets are, as you know, sets are chaos. They're mm-hmm. it's like completely mildly controlled chaos, most likely not controlled chaos. And there's tons of noise and everybody's doing this and that and the other or whatever. And then the cameras roll and it's just everything gets really quiet. And then it's like, okay, now it's my turn and it's their turn and it's the assistant's turn and the my dolly grip's turn. And it's just this unbelievable, magical time. And that to me, it's like, I mean, it's a drug. There's no question about it. But on that note, you're talking to me as a camera operator, but I'm nothing without my assistant and my dolly grip. And also, by the way, our sound guy. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, there's so many people who have to do that dance. I just did the last season of Snowfall. And we had a great assistant on that and dolly grip I've worked with before. And within a week, we were all so in sync with each other that like something would happen and my assistant would just know that he was going to go to it when focus. And I would know that we were going to like frame differently and the dolly grip would do. And it just becomes like jazz. I mean, and the thing about it, that's the best thing in the world for me is you could never plan that stuff. Like those mm-hmm. are those magical moments where you catch something and everybody behind the monitor is just like, oh my God. And you're like, yeah, right. Then of course they go, let's do it again. And you're like, yeah, exactly. Gonna happen?
Before Lizzie pops in with a quick question, I wanted to clarify something, which is that as you're operating the camera, there is another person on set who is pulling focus for
yes.
you. And
yes.
and pulling focus means they are changing the focus distance of the lens in order to keep specific actors or objects in focus. And that's in two objects moving relative to one another that a third person then has to control the relative distance between them. So, and then, you, of course, as you mentioned, you have your dolly grip maybe spotting, and then you've got your sound boom operator moving yep. in tandem behind you. There are a lot of people involved
yeah.
in this oh, dance.
Yeah. So yeah. this is actually, that's actually what I wanted to ask, because you said like, sometimes I'll improvise when the director, you know, will allow me. And mm-hmm. as you're rattling off the people that are kind of surrounding you, I'm envisioning you like some sort of like tentacled octopus. And it's, how are you able to improvise in that environment when you have that many people that are kind of coming with you, and how do you work with them?
Well, it doesn't always work, and you have to know who your people are to know if you can do that. But there are literally times with a really good boom operator, like Ozark was like this. I had a boom operator we're working with, this Jared, who's this great guy. And you know, if something was going to change, I would just throw him a look, and he would go, okay, mm-hmm. something's happening. And because, you know, I don't have my eye up to the camera when I'm doing Steadicam, my head's, you know, so I'll just throw him a nod, and he'll know that something's happening. And then I'll, you know, usually it's usually not a whip pan or something like that.
Right.
But even that, you know, things like that can work. But what you end up doing is you end up, hopefully, if you're doing it well and you're doing it right, recognizing what you can get away with and what you can't. I mean, obviously, because of lighting and because of this and that, and you have to keep in mind, like the director of photography, you don't want to do something that's going to jeopardize what they've done. I think the other thing I'll say actually is, a lot of assistants and dolly grips that I work with that I haven't worked with before, within a week or two, will go, oh, I see what's going on. Like, I have to be paying attention at every possible moment because mm-hmm, this could change. Mm-hmm. But also, I will also try to be very wary of understanding that if I do a sudden lurch in and the assistant doesn't know about it, they're just never, I mean, there's no way they're going to do it. So I don't want to throw them under the bus, you know?
Right.
And then a lot of times what will happen is, you know, we'll do take three and take four and take five, and I'll put the Steadicam down or even on the dolly, and I'll go up to the assistant and I'll go, look, I have a feeling, I'm making something up here, I have a feeling that he's going to step forward on this line because he seems to be doing it every time. And when he does it, I want to crush in on him. So just be ready for that. And they're like, okay. So you give him a heads up, you know. Mm. And then the other part of it to me, which is the beauty of all of this, is if you're not prepared to fail, you're never going to do you're never going to get the good stuff. You know what I mean? It's like, it's like acting. It's like, you know, the great performances are always on that line of just being absolutely horrible, but they don't quite go there. You know, it's like, so I always say to the assistants I work with in the dolly group, you know, I'd rather you go for it and we screw up and I'll take the bullet than we don't ever try anything, do you know?
Yeah.
But it of course depends on who you're working for.
Yeah. Sounds like it just requires a lot of trust of you and all the people around you. And
yeah, and sometimes it's not there and sometimes it doesn't work. But to me, that's where, that's, you know, that's sort of where the good stuff is.
Totally. You also, you mentioned that your rig weighs, you said what, like 40, 45 pounds?
It depends on the camera and other things, yeah.
What is that? I mean, as someone who just sits glued to a computer with no weight on them all day, I can't imagine what that does to your body.
Oh, it's horrible.
What is the sort of like, what's the actual physical toll of doing your job? I mean, that seems crazy. I hold my cat sometimes. He weighs like 12 pounds.
Well, I don't know how big your cat is. Maybe your cat. Well, the physical toll on me has actually been significant because I've been doing this for 33 years or 32 years or something like that.
Wow.
And now I look at the Steadicam and I'm like, oh, that's painful. But, mm-hmm. The reason I say that is because when I got into it, things were not, people like ergonomic wasn't a word. People are like, here, put this on and mm-hmm. run around with it. And it's just like, should it hurt? Yeah, it should hurt because it makes you strong. Eat your Wheaties. I've got a herniated disc that I've worked mm-hmm. through and, my shoulder has been screwed up and this and that and the other. So this business takes its toll on you. And there are times I know for a fact that I show up on set and people are like, that's the Steadicam operator. And, you know, and then they'll do this like, you know, this like, we're going to do this huge, huge Steadicam shot down three things. And I'm like, or we mm-hmm. could put a wide angle in the corner and just let the whole thing play because yeah. that would be organic. So you get really good at like talking people out of shots.
Sure.
Organic is a really good word to use mm-hmm. that directors mm-hmm. like.
I might need to use that at my job.
Yeah. But no, I will say when I was younger, the big thing was recovery. It takes me a lot longer to recover from a big day than it used to be. But I still get through it. And I mean, I do a lot more stretching than I used to, that's for sure. But it does take its toll. There's no question. I'll also say that like when I get massages from like someone I haven't before, they usually get to my lower back and there's kind of like a poke and then they stop and then they're sort of like, what exactly do you do for a living?
Because yeah.
I have sort of muscle groups there that most people don't have.
Interesting.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I have a question that I think Lizzie follows up well on that one, which is we've obviously transitioned to digital capture for most projects at this point. Film is expensive. Hard drives, actually economics are debatable when you really go into them. But,
oh, completely debatable. Yeah.
I have a question. Yeah. And so in terms of the cost that might be borne by your crew, digital allows a lot of takes. And yep. it allows a lot of takes when maybe you should take more time to figure out a better way to do the shot, for example. Mm. I don't want to speak for you, Dave, but I'm curious if you have felt that getting more takes is overall an advantage, you know, for you, or is this just going to enable potentially bad, like sort of a let's just keep beating the dead horse behavior yeah. when it comes to capturing shots.
I think digital has destroyed a large part of this industry. I hate to be that blunt, but the thing is, it used to be that you rehearsed because you had to get it right because you were expending something. Like there was like,
exactly.
you know, I mean, you can always get more film, but it's like, we only have 2,000 feet of film for the day or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so you rehearsed it and you did it right. And now the thing is like, let's shoot the rehearsal. Maybe magic will happen. And our thing is always
favorite,
like,
that's always my favorite term though. Maybe Jesus. Magic will happen.
Well, and like, the thing that
we've
I always
not
wanna,
even tried it.
I know. But the thing that I always want to go is like, first of all, magic doesn't happen. We're good at our jobs. That's what
yeah,
we're
exactly.
talking about. So let's call it what it is. But secondly, then you'll shoot the rehearsal and they'll be like, well, that didn't work. And it's like, yeah, that's because we never rehearsed it, you know? And it's just like, and the other thing is that's weird is, you know, the Steadicam has like a post going through it with the camera on top. And it when we went to digital, it took me a little bit to get this through my head because what I realized was when I could feel the film vibrating through the rig, I knew it was go time. Like I knew something was happening. Mm-hmm. And it used to be that when we rolled film, like something I don't want to put too big of a thing on it, but like sort of something big was happening, you know, mm-hmm. something was happening. And now it's like, eh, whatever, we'll cut and we'll go again. But, you know, it drives me nuts. I often, you know, ask them to cut just for the sake of the editors. Also, by the way, something else people don't think about is like we shoot 2 hours of 2 hours of digital. Our loader has to sit in the truck and download for 2 hours, you know? Mm-hmm. So if we finish at the end of the night and there's an hour and a half of stuff to be downloaded, well, they got another hour and a half to go.
And processing those dailies is still expensive, very expensive, and getting them uploaded for the studio.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
there are all sorts of costs that people don't think about.
Well, and
when you're
by the
burning.
Way, I don't want to go into a whole tangent, but one thing I'll mention is that people don't think about all of this digital stuff has to sit on some sort of medium, like a hard drive. And that hard drive has to be replaced every couple of years, and it has to be run all the time. It's like a whole thing. Anyway.
Yeah. We'll get into the environmental impacts at the end, Dave, because I did look into your background on that front as well.
Not a big fan of digital. I mean, look, there are certain aspects of it that really it makes it more accessible to people, and there are good parts to it. But overall, the times when I get to shoot film still, it's just like, this is fantastic, you know?
What's the last project you shot on film?
The last project I shot on film was Widows with Steve McQueen.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that movie looked great.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
It was Steve McQueen and Sean Bobbitt are like, they're the dream team. They're unbelievable.
And you did Shame with them
I did Shame.
As well. Yeah, that's great.
That's where I met them. Actually, they had like no money, and I had an agent at the time, and he called me up, and he goes, these people like they want you to come out and da-da-da. And I was just like, yes. And he goes, what? And I said, do you have any idea who Steve McQueen is? Because he'd only done Hunger. And he goes, no. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, first of all, we're going to have to talk. I remember saying to him, I said, listen, I want to do this because I am never going to work with Martin Scorsese when he does Mean Streets, but I will work with Steve McQueen when he does his next movie. And it was everything. He was phenomenal.
What do you look for in a director? Like when you, is it just 'cause that you love their work, or was it something about him in particular that you were like, I have to work with him?
I didn't know anything about him. I just seen Hunger. Have you ever seen Hunger?
Yeah.
Hunger, the thing about Hunger to me is, it's a movie that nobody else could make. Mm-hmm. Someone else could make it, but it wouldn't be that movie. It has a vision, and it has an imprint on it, and it's his movie. And I thought it was a brilliant way to tell that story on every level. And so I was just so excited to work with someone like that, because the reality is you work with really, really mediocre people a lot, and you work with a lot of crappy people. I'm not only talking about directors, I'm talking about across the board.
Sure.
And occasionally you get to work with someone who's just stupendous at what they do. And to me, that's the most incredible time. It's just like, that's what I got into this for, you know? And he's just an incredible storyteller. He's amazing. And Sean Bobbitt, his cinematographer, is as well. The two of them together are a dream team.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Something that I've often noticed on set, and I'm sure you have, when a shot is not properly prepared or you're running behind on time, there can be a temptation to throw the camera on Steadicam and let's put it on Steadicam and just kind of wing it. Can you walk us through, you've talked about rehearsal and kind of, I think, what it takes to do a prepared shot. Can you talk to me about the pain of having to do an unprepared shot as a storyteller on set and kind of help the audience understand like the cost of an unfocused shot as it reverberates through, you know, starting with you all the way down to the edit, you know what I'm saying, in terms of how it works?
Yeah.
And also, like, are there shots where you felt uncomfortable or been asked to do something where you felt unsafe or uncomfortable?
Unsafe, there definitely have. I mean, everybody has. It's just the way that it is. Hopefully people listen to you that. But to your question, it's just like there's this thing of like, I don't know, we're not quite sure what it is, but let's just put the Steadicam on and sort of find it. Let's find it. And it's just always like, first of all, who is we? Who's the let's in this? Because it seems like only one of us is going to hold the Steadicam. It's look, there's a certain part of that that drives me nuts, because it's like, I don't know what you did during prep, but your job was to figure out what this was. And 9 times out of 10, it's because they don't know. And unfortunately, one of the things that happens both with handheld and with Steadicam is sort of like, well, and nobody will say this, but it's like, the scene really isn't working, so let's just give it some movement. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, that's not the answer. Of course, by that point, you know, you're not rewriting or whatever. So then what you end up doing as a Steadicam operator, and I'm assuming you're talking about a situation maybe where the director is not as involved in sort of going, hey, you go in there and figure it out and then I'll look good. And, you know, so there is, I will say, a sort of, that can be kind of fun, to be perfectly honest. I recently did a show with a scene with 7 actors, and it was clear that the director did not have a job, and the AD was have an idea. And
he didn't have a job after that.
That's not the way the business works, unfortunately, because someone did a good job and he's going to put it on his reel. But then what you do is you go, okay, so let's sort of like just, okay, let's have the actors walk through it and see where we're going and see kind of what falls in. And then you sort of find some sort of a master. But then as you're going, you're literally in your head going, okay, we're going to have to come back and we're going to get that piece. We're going to have to get that piece. And we're going to have to get this piece. And then this piece can connect to that piece. So there is sort of a fun aspect to that. But the thing that drives me nuts is 9 times out of 10, at the end of the day, what you end up with was, yeah, the scene works. And it's just like, we're not in, I'm not in the business to go, this, it works. I'm in the business to go, you had a great idea. Because my thing is always, there's so much that goes on before I ever get, you know, handed the camera that I can't control, right? So I can't control the writing. I can't control the casting. I can't control so many things. So my thing is always, the way I view my job, or the way I view an operator's job, is, my job is to take what they've given me and make it better, right? Is to push the boulder up the hill a little bit. And if I've done that, then I think I've done my job. But if the boulder's at the bottom of the hill when they give it to me, I'm like, wait a minute. I improved it, but it doesn't make it good, you know? So that can be very frustrating. Like I said, it also is sort of liberating, because you're like, oh, nobody really has an opinion, so let's do this, you know. And there are times where we've come up with something really good. But that said, and I mentor a lot of younger operators, and I always tell them this, that is where understanding the story and the script, like, to the nth degree comes in, because you totally know why the characters are doing what they're doing and where it's going. And, oh, this person has to have that moment and this and that and the other, which you shouldn't, because it's not your job. It's someone else's job. But sometimes you have to be there. And there are sometimes where we'll be in there and be like, hey, don't we need this moment here? Why? Well, because like 4 scenes from now, like, she's going to have this thing going. Oh yeah, we have to get that. That's absolutely. And you're like, why am I coming up with this? Mm-hmm. But you know, that's the way I look at it. So it's like, you know, you read the script over and over and over, just so you know it like the back of your hand, hopefully.
You know, it's interesting what you just said about like you needing to also know, because you're going to be able to sort of pick things up. It reminded me a little bit of, we also recently interviewed an intimacy coordinator, and she said something sort of similar, where she was like talking to Michaela Cole, and Michaela Cole is like walking her through a whole scene, and the Ida, the intimacy coordinator, was like, well, none of this is on the page.
Yeah.
And it's there's something so interesting about the filmmaking process that like so much prep and groundwork really has to happen. And everybody has to be part of that information resource because everyone is part of the story that has to be told. And
100%. Yeah.
It's so cool to hear you talk about this.
It's really easy to think like the script is for the actors to know their lines.
Yeah.
The script is the blueprint for every single person on set to understand where they are in the story and how that part of the story is going to be told
it's
at any particular moment.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. I mean, and I'll go and highlight stuff for moments that we can make sure we get. And, you know, the reality is, the hope is that someone's going to tell me all that, right? Because someone else should have the idea. And I may be wrong. I mean, at the end of the day, there are a lot of times where I'm like, all right, I'm going to do that. I think you're totally wrong, but I'm going to do that because that's my job. And I've been wrong, you know, because I just haven't, I'm not seeing it the way that they're seeing it. But at the end of the day, it's the director's vision that you're trying to get out there, right? It's not your vision because that's not who you are. And I've actually directed before, so I've been on that side of it too. So it's like a whole, that's a whole different thing. Yeah, I mean, you know, so it's, by the way, I love the intimacy coordinator interview. It was great.
There's our plug. Go listen to it, guys.
Yes, you all should listen to it. It's really great because it's this fascinating job that I don't think people understand. And I was saying to Chris before you came on that one of the things that kind of amazes me with the really good ones is they'll check in with me. And they'll be like, hey, how are you doing? And I'm like, really? So I'm doing all right. Because, you know, it's a weird thing to be involved in.
Yeah, you're in there too. You're probably closer than a lot of other people.
Oh, yeah. There's no question about it. So, yeah.
Let's hop to the next question.
Okay.
We'll give you a moment to think. My question is, which shot are you most proud of in your entire career? But while you think about that for 1 second, I have a Donnie Darko question.
I thought you were just going to go straight to Donnie Darko.
Yeah. So why is it this shot in Donnie Darko that I've picked
Yes.
Early in the film, his first on-screen sleepwalking incident, you go down the stairs, and then there is a push towards the door where you tilt up to the chandelier.
To the chandelier.
And then you come down as the door is closing. And we never actually see him enter or leave frame. And it's one of my, that's one of my favorite shots.
Oh, really? Hey, you know ever. What? Props Did to you because that's the shot nobody ever brings up. I kind of forgot about that shot. I do like that shot.
I was like, oh, maybe that's a dolly shot. But the more I thought about it, no, that was probably a Steadicam shot.
I think it's a Steadicam shot because I had to bring him down and sort of like and dance around with him and go up as he went down.
Anyway, I just wanted to say that is my nerding out. That's my favorite shot. That's actually one of my favorite shots ever, but it's certainly my favorite shot in that movie. And in terms of telling the story, here's why I love that shot.
Mm-hmm.
You guide him out of the house, but no one sees him leave, and you don't let us see him leave either. And you plant the chandelier, which is going to come in when the airplane hits in the following scene. And it's great. It's a brilliant example of everything you're talking about, where it's like the camera is operating in perfect harmony with both the story and the lead actor and character. And it tells you everything you need to know. But again, it's not showy. It's not, you know what I mean? Like I noticed it because I've watched that movie so many times.
Sure.
Anywho, so great example.
Well, that's great. Thank you. I will tell you without even knowing, that's 100% Richard Kelly. Richard Kelly knew every inch of that movie and did not listen to anybody because he knew it so well and he was right.
No, clearly 100%. He was 100% right.
It was kind of astonishing. But I will say you said something that you weren't sure if it was a dolly shot, you weren't sure if it was a Steadicam shot. So to me, that means that it worked because the thing is, you should never think about, I mean, you're a couple, you know, showings in, but you should never think about it. The guy who trained me in Steadicam,
Bob Krohn was his name.
He sat us down and he talked to us about the business of Steadicam or whatever. And he said, the irony of what we do is that if we've done it well, nobody will ever know we did it. And I always thought that was great. It's like, because if they're watching your shot, then they're not watching the movie. So that's cool. Thank you. You know, favorite shots are there. So it's sort of hard to pull out. But the one that I kind of am really proud of is there's a shot in Shame that is in the subway and follows him up the stairs and then comes around very slowly. And the thing that I like about it is it's the freneticism of he's looking for this woman and he can't find her. And he's sort of dodging people and whatever. And we did, and that was the first shot I ever did with Sean and Steve, actually. And those stairs were pretty hard. But we did like one or two takes, and Sean came over to me and he was like, it doesn't have the feeling that I want. And I said, you know what? I think I know what it is. And I pulled the AD over and I said, do you mind if I talk to the extras? He said, yeah. And I called him over. I said, hey, I'm Dave. I'm the Steadicam operator. I'm going, you know what I'm doing now, right? I said, don't get out of my way. And they were like, huh? I said, don't get out of my way. Make me go around you. I mean, don't hit me. Mm-hmm. Like, don't purposely. But if I'm coming at you, make me go. And they were, and I said, here's the thing. He has to dodge you. Mm-hmm. So I have to dodge you. And it does, they don't do as much as I would have liked, but they do enough that I'm trying to keep up with him. And then when it gets up to the top and he realizes that she's gone, it totally smooths out, and it's a really complicated shot to do. And the thing to me is the reason besides the technical aspects of it are just, I think it's a great way to tell that story. And I will say the person who deserves the most props for that shot is Ludovic Liddy, who is now a great DP, but was the focus puller. That was on film. And at the very top of the thing, I come around and I'm like, oh, it's going great. And it's going great. And we come into Michael Fassbender's thing. And at the last minute, he just leans back and I went, because it was like, it was so imperceptible, but I knew exactly what it was. And we watch him go down the stairs and we cut, and I turned to Ludo and I said, Ludo. And he goes, I got it. And I was like, yes.
That's the best.
And that was filmed. So there was no, there's no playback or whatever, but he knew exactly what I was worried about, but he was on it. And if he hadn't been, that shot wouldn't have been usable. So
that's so cool.
They're just like that shot. There are so many nuances in that shot that I love. So,
As soon as, cause I know what shot you're talking, I mean, it's an incredible, it's such a, like an anxiety inducing, segment. And hearing you talk about that is just so cool, because like that shot just wouldn't make me feel the way that it does if you hadn't
that's
done
great.
That
means we did our job. I mean, yeah. You know, but it's a full team, right? It's like the ADs and it's Michael and it's me and it's the cinematographer. It's like all that, and the main thing to me is like, yeah, you have this really hard part of the job, but everybody has hard stuff. And it's just like, you don't want to drop the ball. Like, right. You're like, let someone else drop the ball if it doesn't work. But I don't want to be the one to drop the ball. There's also the famous one that everybody sort of talks about is there's a shot in West Wing called an episode called Five Votes Down. It's episode 3 or 4. And it's this massive shot in the Biltmore Hotel. And I just think of it because, I mean, I'm very proud of it, but it was like 2 flights of stairs. And I mean, wow. it was insanely big to the point that I was the operator in West Wing. And they go, hey, we got this idea for a shop, but we're not sure it's doable. And they kept me on the clock after we wrapped to drive down to the Biltmore to walk through it. And they were like, can you do this? And I was, I don't know, 29 or whatever. And I was like, yeah, sure. And the next day I'm thinking to myself, like, what the hell did I do here? I think we did 16 takes of it. And the one that's in there, I think, is take 11. And I remember very specifically that I think it was either take 9 or take 7, where just, it's one of those things where everything worked. Like everything worked. And sometimes you just know, like you're doing it, you're like, this is it. And then of course they say they want another one and you're like, I'm going to kill everybody here. but everything was working. And we got to the very end where there's really nothing left to do but just walk backwards and finish up. And I kicked the Steadicam with my knee.
And it went
up in the air, and I was like, oh my, and I remember Martin Sheen goes, oh man, and I just, it was absolutely horrible. And I'll tell you something, I don't tell a lot of people this. I went over into a corner and I literally thought I was going to cry. I was so upset with myself. And I was just like, cause you never want to drop the ball. Right.
Yeah.
And everything was going so well. I'd forgotten about this. I mean, I remember about it, but I can't believe I'm telling you this. And I'm standing there and I feel a hand on my shoulder and I realize that Brad Whitford, who's the funniest person in the world and still a good friend of mine. And he comes up to me and he comes very, very like unnaturally close to my ear. And he quietly goes, you're a huge disappointment.
Yes.
And he just walked away. And I remember thinking like, yeah, okay. And, you know, then I walked upstairs. And actually, I walked upstairs. And by the time I got there, Martin came and like patted me on the back and sort of grabbed my neck and squeezed me. And it was his way of going like, you know, I'm sorry. I didn't mean, you know. They were great people. Yeah,
I feel like having Bradley Whitford call you a huge disappointment would be an amazing bucket list item that we all should go for.
Brad Whitford on West Wing. I just ran into him in a plane, actually, like 2 weeks ago. We were talking about this. There was one shot on West Wing. I don't remember why he had a scarf in the scene. And they said, all right, we're up. And I had my Steadicam, you know, my arm on, and I was about to put the rig on. And he flipped his scarf back and turned to me and said, pick up your tools of ignorance, camera boy, and follow me to greatness, and then walked out the room. And I, to this day, it's like one of the funniest so things good. Anyone's ever said to me. He's as funny as you would think he is. He's
so funny. We could talk about Brad Whitford.
No, I know. Actually, man, I'll tell you one other thing. Is like I got on the plane, and of course, he's in first class, and I saw him, and he saw me, and he starts pushing the thing. So I go back, and I sit in steerage, and I texted him, and he texts me back, and he says, I don't understand. Why are texts from the common people reaching first class? Yeah, he's great. Anyway.
Well, Dave, thank you so much. This has been an absolute pleasure. So much of a pleasure that we're going to talk to Dave on another episode as well. So you're not rid of him yet. Chris, I know you wanted to share a little bit before we sign off as well.
Yeah, Dave, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. It has been a true pleasure. And for all of our listeners out there, you can learn more about Dave. Obviously, you can IMDb him, you can watch his work,
or you can also go to his website, theop.io. That is theop.io. There you can explore a ton of resources that he has made available as someone who has been on more sets than most of us can dream to be in our lifetimes.
Dave, thank you again for giving us this time, your incredible experience, and your stories. We deeply appreciate it.
Well, thank you. This was an absolute blast. I am a huge, huge fan of your podcast. I just want to read this correctly. It's the hands down best podcast ever created. Is that how I'm saying? Is that what I'm
saying? Thank
you.
Full stop.
That's the line we gave to you.
But no, it really is. I emailed you guys simply because I'm a huge fan. And ever since I heard The Island of Dr. Moreau, which I listen to almost nightly, I love it. But this has actually been really great. And I so appreciate it. And to anyone out there listening, if you want to really understand who I am, you can go to Instagram and look up hashtag Dave's Down. So that's the meat and potatoes right there.
I highly recommend it. I'm doing it right now. I don't want to spoil
really
what it is.
I really like it.
I highly recommend it. We'll link to it through the What Went Wrong Instagram as well. Thanks, guys, for listening. Thank you, patrons, for supporting us. And until next time, this has been Chris Winterbauer and Lizzie Bassett with What Went Wrong.
Bye.
What Went Wrong is a Sad Boom podcast presented by Lizzie Bassett and Chris Winterbauer. Editing and music by David Bowman, with cover art from Euthana Uos.